Scripture reading this morning is Psalm 31. For those of you who don't know, I teach Old Testament. Far be it from me to read anything less than a whole psalm. In you, O Lord, I seek refuge. Do not let me ever be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. You are indeed my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, lead me and guide me. Take me out of the net that is hidden for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. You hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will exult and rejoice in your steadfast love, because you have seen my affliction. You have taken heed of my adversities and have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye wastes away from grief, my soul and body also. For my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my misery, and my bones waste away. I am the scorn of all my adversaries, a horror to my neighbors, an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have passed out of mind like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel. For I hear the whispering of many, terror all around as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and persecutors. Let your face shine upon your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. Do not let me be put to shame, O Lord, for I call on you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go dumbfounded to Sheol. Let the lying lips be stilled that speak insolently against the righteous with pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness that you have laid up for those who fear you and accomplished for those who take refuge in you in the sight of everyone. In the shelter of your presence, you hide them from human plots. You hold them safe under your shelter from contentious tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me. When I was beset as a city under siege, I had said in my alarm, I am driven far from your sight. But you heard my supplications when I cried out to you for help. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts haughtily. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. And from the New Testament, the Gospel of John, chapter 11, verses 17 through 37. It just would have taken too long to read this whole chapter. Sorry. You can go home and read it. When Jesus arrived, this is after his friends Mary and Martha had called for him, saying their friend Lazarus, or their brother Lazarus, was dying and needed him. When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world." When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, "The teacher is here and calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" May we hear what the Spirit is saying to the church today from these words from so long ago. And hopefully that was a tantalizing enough tidbit that you'll want to go read the rest of John 11. Grief is like a fart. You can laugh, it's okay. It's supposed to be funny, but it's true too. Just think about it, right? Better out than in. And not that many people want to be around when you do it, right? Yeah. Grief is like a fart. Well, I'm going to get back to that. We'll unpack that, so to speak, a little more in a bit. But first, I have to take a little sidebar. Because somebody said to me a month or 6 weeks ago, "Well, Lisa, would you preach the Sunday after Kathy's last Sunday?" And so I thought, well, I'll preach on grief, right? Because deep breath, everybody. This is no longer Kathy McCallie's church. So I thought, you know, that's probably cause for some grief and, you know, some stuff we need to work on as a congregation, right? So I've been thinking about it, working on it, doing a little work with the text, doing some research and stuff. And then Wednesday, I was partying and really excited about the Supreme Court thing. And then I went, oh, you know, at our church, people are going to be wanting to have, like, rainbow cupcakes, not grief. So I thought, well, do I revise the sermon? Do I change the title? What do I do? But, you know, life is like that, right? There's grief and joy all together, mixed in at the same time. It's kind of like the Christian year. I remember one year that it was a terrible year in my life. And when Lent came around, I thought, finally, because I felt like it had been Lent for a while. And this is why Christmas is really hard for some people, because especially if you've experienced a loss around Christmas and everybody else is acting really happy and excited and it's a lot of fun and you don't feel like that. Now, the Psalms are like this. I don't know how much you've worked with the Psalms, but did you know that at least or approximately a third of the book of Psalms are lament psalms. That's a lot. That's a lot. And if you read a lament psalm, which I did this morning with Psalm 31, you probably noticed it had some lament. I mean, this person has had a hard time. I'm an object of I'm the scorn of all my adversaries. That's pretty bad. Some of us have felt that way from time to time. But did you also notice there's a lot of praise and thanksgiving there too? And this is the nature of a lament psalm, that all, except for one, lament psalms have both lament or complaint, grief, but also joy, thanksgiving, praise. They're all wrapped up together like that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that one of the best spiritual practices somebody can engage in is to read the book of Psalms one by one, one for each day, and don't pick them according to how you feel. He was very clear about that. You just read the next one that's coming. So that it's sort of like, I don't know, emotional exercise. Because it makes you have a little empathy for, because somebody's feeling that way that day, right? So grief and joy are often intermingled. Now, the other part of my sidebar that's just kind of funny to me, anyway, is that I had chosen this passage from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 11, about Jesus crying. It's a memorable passage, and it really shows Jesus' human side. And I chose it to go with the whole grief theme, right? But then this one particular politician this week, I don't know if you heard this or not, but this former Arkansas governor apparently tweeted that this verse, it's John 11 verse, I don't remember now. But anyway, the King James Version says, Jesus wept. It's verse 35. And so anyway, that was what he said was his response to the Supreme Court decision on Wednesday. And so then apparently somebody else tweeted in response, well, those were tears of joy. And anyway, it's not about that, actually. So I'll talk about that a little more. But it just had to make me laugh that, you know, it's here of all places and that I picked that text and then this politician picked that text. So I thought that was funny. So grief is like a fart. Better out than in. As I said, it hurts if you hold it in. It's going to come out eventually, right? And it's nice if you can be a little judicious about, you know, when, where, with whom and stuff. You know, like there are certain people who maybe it's okay. You know, it's kind of a marker in a relationship for some people, I think. Grief is like a fart. It's very important to get grief out. And I think that it's going to be something that we as a congregation will need to work on a little bit. Now, I got this phrase, this simile, right? Grief is like a fart, from the Reverend Bobby Predmore. Now, Bobby Predmore was my supervisor at Children's Medical Center in Dayton, Ohio, more than 20 years ago, when I was in seminary, and I was a chaplain intern at Children's Hospital there with Bobby. Now, Bobby, as you can imagine, based on this simile that I stole from her, is an interesting kind of pastor. She was very unique in that she could actually conduct a funeral for a child, and people would be laughing in the midst of their tears, partly because she's that funny, but she also just kind of knows how to fold in grief and joy and help us look at ourselves and laugh and remember that there's going to be joy again. That was a hard job, I'll say that. Children's Hospital chaplain, yeah. That was a hard job. I tried it full-time for 2 months, and that was all. So I did it part-time after that for a number of years. It did teach me to appreciate the gift of life and to appreciate every moment. Every moment, as much as possible. I mean, there are times when it's hard, you know, like at the grocery store with your two preschoolers. Like by the end, I'm doing my yoga breathing and going, oh boy, probably how my husband feels right now. And so there are those times. But I learned that life changes, life can change that quickly. And when my beeper would go off, I knew that was it for somebody. And that it just, you know, you can't live thinking that all the time. You have to live assuming life's going to be cool. It's going to be good. It'll be all right. Otherwise, you just couldn't go on. That's the only way to do it. But somehow, I think most of us know kind of at the back of our mind, you just never know if you'll make it home or whatever. Now, weeping, I think... weeping, crying, right, is an integral part of the life of faith. And one thing I learned as a chaplain was that probably one of the most important things I could do was bring tissues and coffee or water and help clear the room of people who did not know how to shut up. Those were probably my most important jobs. Tissues, coffee or water, get other people to shut up. Because if you've read the book of Job, the most helpful his friends ever were was when they sat with him in silence for 7 days. Then they started talking and it got really ugly. But it's hard to be silent when somebody is really in a lot of pain. That's the right thing to do. That's just a little tip. So, hence the tissue packs for the pew, they're sort of pews here. I always have thought there should be little built-ins for tissues at church because it's a time, it's a place. I read a friend's post the other day on Facebook where she said, is it just me or do other people sit down in church and just begin to weep? I don't think it's just her. Sometimes it's an emotional place to be, and I think it should be that way. So, you know, let's all chip in some tissue packs. I don't have enough for every chair. So it's right for us to grieve our pastor, Kathy. I miss her. We'll probably miss her more. You know, we missed her last summer, but then we knew she was coming back. And she was here a long time. It was right for us to think of it as Kathy McCallie's church, because really it was for our whole life in a lot of ways. So missing her is appropriate, and grieving her is appropriate. Not everybody will need to grieve much. Some people will grieve in different ways than others. This is often a source of tension in grieving families, that some people grieve silently and some people grieve very publicly, and it differs one from another. I've also noticed that we don't grieve the bad stuff. When you've lost somebody, you might want to think about this a little bit if you've lost somebody in your life before. And I know Kathy didn't die. I don't mean to make it sound that way, but... we tend to put somebody on a pedestal when they're out of our lives, if we miss them, if it didn't end badly. And so that might be a thing that happens too. So Jesus grieved in John, and no, he wasn't crying over the demise of the Defense of Marriage Act, either with joy or sadness. So just to be clear there. He was crying over the grief of a family. So his close friends, Mary and Martha, Mary, it says early in the passage, this is the Mary who had anointed Jesus' feet and wiped them with her hair, a very powerful story in the text. They had sent word that their brother Lazarus had died. And when they finally met him, when he was on the way to their house, they were all crying. And did you catch twice he gets this, I don't know, you could kind of interpret it as a guilt trip. If you had been here, if you had come in time, our brother wouldn't have died. But I know you can take care of it now, right? And so it's after he sees the grief of the community, of his friends Mary and Martha, and the other people from the faith community who are with him. It's when he sees all their grief and is exposed to it that he begins to weep. I mean, maybe he's sad about Lazarus' death, but it doesn't actually say that. It says that he begins to weep when he sees them weeping. And I think that happens to us. You know, that's what happens in a sad movie, right? We don't know those people. They're not real. But you cry. We can relate to it. It's empathy. We cry for other people sometimes. And that's what Jesus does here. It emphasizes his humanity, which, if you're a nerd of the Bible like I am, is really fascinating, because the Gospel of John is not that crazy about Jesus' humanity. The Gospel of John has a really high Christology. Jesus is God. And while I don't mean to undermine that, it's just interesting in John here that Jesus has this very human moment, while at the same time, of course, emphasizing his divinity by saying, "I am the resurrection and the life," which is pretty powerful too. So Jesus has wept with the community. We have an opportunity to weep as a community. I'm just inviting you all. It doesn't have to be now. I think it might be an important thing for us to do. But as I said at the start, the Psalms teach us that grief never just comes all by itself. It also comes with praise, assurance, trust in God. And so I'm here to bring some of that as well. We are a part of the United Church of Christ. And if you want to be a UCC geek, you can log on and see everything that's going on at Synod right now in Long Beach, and see the kind of discussions they're having and worship and stuff like that, and look for Mark Van Dorn in the pictures. In the United Church of Christ, we have a very unique structure or polity. We don't have bishops. And we do have a conference minister. Some of you have met her, Edith Guffey. She's been to our church. She has kind of limited power in our structure. In the United Church of Christ, what we say is, Jesus Christ is the head of the church. In fact, when I used to teach UCC history and polity to seminary students who were going to become UCC pastors, or pastors from other denominations who wanted to be UCC pastors, I would always kind of joke around with them and say, you know, if you get stuck in your ordination interview, you can always say, as an answer to any question, Jesus Christ is the head of the church. It's always the right answer. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. And I think for a church in transition, that's probably a helpful thing to remember. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. Oh, right. Of course, Kathy McCallie would not have said, "This is my church." And of course, we all know that. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. In the text from John, it goes well beyond that. As I said, he proclaims, "I am the resurrection and the life," which sounds kind of vague, I think, to us. But in fact, some of the reading that I did, it seems that this was probably a really politically subversive statement that he was making against the emperor at the time, who made kind of similar statements about himself. Jesus is saying, "No, I am the resurrection and the life." So for us, as a denomination, as a congregation, to say Jesus Christ is the head of the church, I think can also be pretty subversive. Now, in case you're not familiar with the rest of John 11, and of course I do hope you go home and read it, and you can get it online if you don't have a Bible, Jesus does resurrect Lazarus. Did you know that? And so that's when he really illustrates that comment. He doesn't just say, "I'm the resurrection and the life." He goes to a tomb where the guy had been dead for 4 days, which is notably longer than 3 days, which was apparently the time at which you had to be dead before they were sure you were dead. So they were sure he was dead. I mean, they talk about the stench. And so he goes up and they move the stone, and you can kind of imagine people going, whoo! And he says, Lazarus, come out. And he does. And in another sort of interesting twist to my choice of this passage for today, I've discovered in my research that this is a popular text in the LGBT community because Jesus says, Lazarus, come out, you know? It's like, it's the coming out day text. So I thought, well, I think probably a former certain Arkansas governor didn't know that. And I think I knew it once, but I kind of had forgotten. So Jesus, I'm the resurrection and the life. What more do we need? Jesus Christ is the head of the church. Well, okay. Maybe we do need more than that, right? I mean, there's a story about a little girl who's trying to go to sleep, and she doesn't want to go to sleep, and it's dark, and she's scared, and she says, Mommy, will you come and sit with me? And she says, well, honey, you can always pray to Jesus, and he'll be with you. And she says, Mommy, I need somebody with skin on. And I think we do too. I mean, who can't relate to that, right? We want somebody with skin on. We want a pastor. And we have plenty of good leadership, and we know we can get more good leadership, long-term leadership. We want somebody with skin on. But first, I think we do have to grieve. We kind of have to figure out who we are as a congregation before we can pick the new right next person. So I'm a trained interim pastor, and I've served as an interim pastor. And one of the reasons that we say interim ministry is important is so that we can do those things, so that we can work with a congregation and help them say, wait a minute, we better figure out really who we are. Aside from Kathy McCallie's church, we're going to have to pretty much shed that identity and figure out who we are and who we want to be and where we want to go, and then we'll be able to do a good job of choosing a long-term pastor. So there's my plug for interim ministry. It might take a while. I just want to warn you. It might take a while. I'm guessing a couple of years, easy. Sorry if you're cringing. Deep breaths. I think that's okay. Interim times can be good for us to figure out who we are, where we want to go, what we want to be. These things are kind of slow. I just want to warn you. That's just how it is. Even once you have a good search committee and then you start looking for a pastor, that takes a while. And you can't even do that until you've kind of done the other grief work and gotten to a place where you think you can pick a good search committee and have some people who will be able to do that work. And it is some work. But you know what? It's worth it. This is such a good church. Don't you all think so? I do. So here's my insight, and I mentioned it to a couple of people, and they were really surprised, and so I thought, well, I should tell everybody this while I have this is my big chance, right? So when I used to teach UCC History and Polity, we would always go around the classes and say, my name is, and I'm in seminary, and I want to be UCC. I think I only ever had one person who said, I've been UCC my whole life. Everybody else, well, I came from this denomination or that denomination, or I am ordained in this denomination, but I want to be in this denomination. And it was usually a very high percentage of people who wanted to be in the United Church of Christ because of our open views on ordination of LGBT folks. Isn't that remarkable? But the thing that happened to me while I was standing up in front of them is I had this dilemma because I knew that there weren't all that many churches who shared their views. I mean, there are some, and certainly more in the UCC than in other denominations, But I was always afraid there aren't enough churches for all these people who have this as a really driving force behind their desire to be a part of the United Church of Christ. But that's really good news for us, right? Because we're cool with that, right? We are, you know, in the Pride Parade, and we're celebrating the demise of DOMA and Prop 8, and, you know, our church has been celebrating union services since its inception, and so I think, I mean, I can't swear it, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think, with a fairly informed point of view, I think there are going to be some really awesome pastors who want to come to our church. Really, I am serious. Some really awesome, amazing, wonderful pastors who want to come to our church. So, no inferiority complex, folks. No, none of that. No, don't be feeling, oh, we're a small church and we haven't been around that long and who's going to want to come to this church? And, you know, the other churches in town think we're weird and stuff like that. I think some really awesome, amazing pastors are going to want to come to our church. And I want you to remember that if you feel downhearted about the whole process. But it's going to work a lot better if we're willing to let the fart out, to do our grieving, to be a community together, to figure out who we are and what we want to be and how we can be together, how, if we can pastor each other for a while and then come to a place where we can find a search committee and look for the person who will be with us long term. Always remembering that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. Amen. This is our opportunity to celebrate that.